Hello, good morning, and welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I am very excited about today's show on Line One, and we will be answering all of your questions about diets. There are many reasons someone may want to change their diet, such as weight loss, diabetes, heartburn, or maybe GI disorders like irritable bowel syndrome, inflammatory bowel disease, or celiac disease. There are also endless types of diets out there, such as keto, Atkins, low calorie, low fat, low carb, intermittent fasting, gluten-free, and FODMAP. However, changing your diet is one of the hardest things for people to do long-term. Having the help of a registered dietitian can make a huge difference. Today, I am pleased to be joined by three registered dietitians from Dietitians of Alaska, Erica Van Kalkar, Soleil Thiel, and Stacy Kloster. You can also be part of our conversation. If you have a question or a comment, please give us a call, toll-free, statewide, at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage at 907-550-8433. That's 907-550-8433. Or you can email me at line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, I want to thank you guys all for being here today. We're going to start with Erica Van Kalkar. Thank you for being with us. I want to give you a chance to introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to be a registered dietitian.
Thank you so much. Gosh, it's a long story with a lot of history. I have actually this year, I am celebrating my 20-year anniversary of being a registered dietitian and my 10-year anniversary of moving up to Alaska. So this is kind of a big year for me. I am a transplant from Washington State, and I became a registered dietitian because I have a passion for talking to people about food, and honestly, because I was in community college and my parents were kind of gave me an ultimatum. It's either find a job or find a career. And so I flipped through a course catalog and found my career. And I haven't looked back, and it's been wonderful.
That's great. That's great. It sounds like that's an awesome story. 20 years.
20 years.
I can't believe it. Okay. And then Soleil, welcome to Line One. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. I'm a newer dietitian. I got my licensure around 3 years ago, and my first job was actually starting at Anchorage Bariatrics and now Dietitians of Alaska. Erica is basically my mentor. She's kind of taught me everything I know, pretty much. But yeah, that's kind of about me. I'm originally from California, but now, yeah, here in Alaska, and I love it.
Good, good. Well, thank you for being with us here today. And finally, Stacy Kloster, welcome to Line One.
Thank you. Born and raised in Alaska, always been my home, likely always will be. Went to UAA through the dietetics program, did the internship here in Alaska, got to do some rural community things, got to see kind of the great state of Alaska while doing it. Kind of what led me to become a registered dietitian was many, many moons ago, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, and that kind of just gave me a passion that kind of one mold doesn't fit everyone when it comes to their diet. So that has kind of led me down the career path of being a dietitian.
Great. Well, that personal experience certainly comes in handy with the patients you see, I imagine.
Yes, it does.
So let's start with the basics. When someone says registered dietitian, Erica, I'll start with you since you're the senior partner here. But what's a registered dietitian? What do you consider it to be?
That's a great question. And I defer back to, I guess, what a registered dietitian is, technically speaking, because it is kind of confusing on social media. If you look online, it it feels like the word registered dietitian and nutritionist are used fairly interchangeably. And I think that's where a lot of the confusion lies, is that a registered dietitian can also be a nutritionist, but a nutritionist can't necessarily be a registered dietitian. There's a little division in terms of like credentialing there. So to be able to use the title of registered dietitian, you need to have a bachelor's degree in a related field, like food science and nutrition, myself as an example, from an accredited institution. You have to complete 1,200 hours of supervised and accredited work experience, internship. You have to pass a nationally recognized exam that is regulated by the Commission on Dietetic Registration. And then every 5 years, you need to complete 75 hours of continuing education from approved sources, which includes at least 1 hour of professional ethics. So there's a lot involved there. To use the title of nutritionist is where it gets a little sticky. Mm-hmm. Every state is a little bit different. Some states have rules and regulations. Some states don't. So in those states, Joe Blow off the street could say, "Hey, I'm a nutritionist," and you know there's no regulation around that. Fortunately, up here in Alaska, we do have regulations. So you can go on to the State of Alaska website and actually look up what those regulations are. And then you can also do a licensure search for either a registered dietitian or a nutritionist. So like if you're going to go talk to somebody, you can look up to make sure that they've done the things, they're licensed in the state.
That's very interesting. And so, Stacey, we'll flip to you next. I think you're the most recently through the program. How long is the training to become a registered dietitian? And, let's start there.
So things have definitely actually even changed since I came through, whereas now, in order to become a registered dietitian, you actually need to have your master's degree. And up until 2024, if I am correct, you didn't have to have a master's degree. So some of the internship that has now kind of morphed into the master's program, there is one here at UAA. So I know that like when I was going through the program, they were offering that as an option, but you essentially had to complete your exam by a certain date of 2024. Otherwise else you needed a master's degree. So things are kind of changing on the horizon as far as kind of the credentialing or schooling that you need to do. Now it's a bit longer.
Got it. So Soleil, to talk a little bit about the nutritionist versus dietitian, and you can punt this if you want, but what do you see either from your patients asking or from your own education about, what are the true differences in what a nutritionist will do for you versus a registered dietitian?
Well, dietitians are the experts on nutrition. Nutritionists, it's hard because there are some nutritionists out there who do go through, you know, programs you have to pay for, and they can give good general nutrition advice. What a nutritionist can't do is they can't provide medical nutrition therapy. So if someone has diabetes or heart disease or something like Crohn's disease, that person would probably want to go see a dietitian because they'd be able to give you better medical advice compared to a nutritionist they don't learn that through their nutrition programs through like NASM, like personal training certifications and things like that. So that's, I would say, the main difference between a nutritionist and a dietitian.
Excellent. Erica, anything to add to that?
No, I think that about covers it.
Good, good. So it sounds like the training's quite involved. I mean, you said 1,200 hours of...
I think I said that right, yeah.
of actual internship. And I imagine that involves several different aspects of nutrition. So there's inpatient and outpatient, mm-hmm. and all of you guys are outpatient therapists, so working with patients outside the hospital. But does your training also involve working inside the hospital? Let's start with Erica.
Yeah. With my internship, I did it at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. So that was where, because I have a master's, and so that's kind of where the master's program went. And then University Hospitals of Cleveland is where I did most of my internship. And I would say a good 80% of it was actually in hospital work. So I was in the ICU, I did the NICU, I did the PICU, general med surge floors, hemodialysis units. So yeah, all over. There's quite a bit of time you actually spend in the kitchen as well. So it's you see a lot of everything.
Good, good. Well, let me give our listeners our call-in numbers again, and then we're gonna kind of get into the nitty-gritty of these calories and diets and stuff, which I'm excited to hear about. The call-in number statewide is 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433, or email at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, well, we do have an email, and I want to get to that in a minute. That's regarding diet and cancer. But let's get some of the basics out of the way first. And so, Stacy, I think you're up here. What is a calorie?
In the most basic form, like amount of energy that is released by the body when you ingest something. So when you look at nutrition labels and you see that a food has X amount of calories, then it is the kind of amount of energy that that food is going to give you.
Awesome. So, and it's very complicated.
it definitely can be. And I think that's also going back to perhaps dietitian versus nutritionist, that also to the amount of science that is needed to become a registered dietitian is oftentimes very shocking, the amount of just science behind it all.
And I'm always curious, I mean, because there's calories, a standard thing. So it's a standard amount of energy, or you know, as you described it. But people burn calories very, very differently. So it doesn't exactly correspond to one person's particular amount of energy expenditure. Would that be okay to say?
Yes. And I also think that skipping ahead when we see the 2,000 calories a day doesn't fit the mold for everybody, because everybody is burning and taking differently.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. Soleil, what's your feeling on this 2,000 calorie a day diet? Like, where did that even come from? I mean, is there any history behind it? Is there any utility to it? Or is it just like a good number to use?
I don't know. I literally don't know the history. I'm sure Erica probably researched that better than I did. But it, like Stacy said, I mean, throwing 2,000 calories at someone, that is not individualized whatsoever. Everyone is, you know, their metabolism is different. You have to think about total daily energy expenditure, which is your basal metabolic rate, your resting metabolic rate, the thermic effect of food. For instance, protein, you kind of take less calories from protein than other foods. So that's why like protein heavy diets are sometimes a good thing. But yeah, there's a lot that goes into it. Everyone is so different. You can't just slap, you know, a number. Like if you sign up for MyFitnessPal, a really popular tracking app, it usually spits a number at you and it's like, okay, why is this number being spit at me right now. But Erica might have more information on the 2,000 calories.
I want to say that it kind of goes back to the old food guide pyramid and, you know, needing to give just a general guideline and just use something. And I think that that's kind of where the just the 2,000 calorie, you know, diet example came from, and really where it's used more often is on food labels. You know, you'll see the food label and give you like the serving size, the number of servings per, you know, per package. And then it goes down in, you know, grams of fat, grams of sodium, grams of protein. And then on the very far right, it gives you these percentages, which are horribly confusing. But they're all, percent that will give you based on a 2,000 calorie diet, which for most of us is just, it's not applicable. So I'm actually kind of surprised that they haven't gotten rid of it by now, just because it's, you know, not many of us eat exactly 2,000 calories every day.
Yeah, I imagine there has to be some sort of kind of standard or I mean, not for person, but like to in order to generalize a food label, I mean, I'm sure they had to pick some sort of number. But well, before we get into some more more interesting questions, I wanted to ask you guys about an email here from Larry. A little complicated, but Larry had prostate cancer, and he wanted to know if there was any particular diets that are used to, per se, like suppress cancer growth or spread, or also hormone-driven cancers like breast and prostate. And then just to give some background, he's also type 2 diabetic and a BMI of 23. And so any thoughts for Larry? And I'll pose, we'll start with Erica here. Tough question, but I'm sure there is some science behind this.
Yeah, and one of my rotations was actually in an oncology unit, but Larry, forgive me. It has been almost—it's been 20 years since I've worked in oncology. But for most cancers, there's no good solid peer-reviewed research on this particular diet would help to suppress, prevent, cure cancer. There's a lot of good correlation, connection, let's say, between like a more Mediterranean way of eating, you know, more whole food, less processed food, but specific, you know, a specific diet, specific foods, not that I recall.
What about things like, per se, what they call now superfoods or something, you know, or low oxidative stuff? Is there any utility? I imagine it's not bad, but is there anything specific that would help, you know, maybe suppress or?
And, you know, again, this is just my opinion, but I think, you know, almost every food can be a superfood in its own right. You know, every food from, like, you know, the blueberry to the watermelon, to, you know, the carrot, to the chicken breast, you know, has, you know, if you want to like continue down the road of super, you know, superfood, it has its own superpower. It has its own benefit in its own right. I think the trouble we run into with labeling something a superfood is that people tend to then fixate on that one particular thing, and it's going to be the thing, and, you know, at the expense of everything else. And I think that's doing the individual a disservice. You know, I think, you know, eating, again, more whole food, less processed food, and a wide variety is going to do the individual a better service.
Okay. So I pose the same question to Soleil or Stacey. Any thoughts on diets for cancer-related things?
And this is Stacey speaking, but I kind of have to agree with Erica just as far as like the Mediterranean diet. It seems like in a lot of research, things go back to the Mediterranean diet mainly for that kind of whole food approach. If you think of having an apple versus having some apple juice, trying to have things that are less processed, whole foods, you're going to get kind of more of that superpower from that food. But also, like Erica said, I don't think that there is any like one very specific honed in diet that is going to cure, you know, all of those things that we want a diet to do for cancer.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, I remember someone telling me once, and I can't remember who it was, but it was, you know, there's vitamins, and maybe we'll get into that if we have time, but, you know, they're like, it's not the beta carotene and the vitamin, it's the carrot. Like it's eating the carrot that provides the benefit, not the individual supplement that comes out of the carrot. I mean, does that make sense, Soleil?
Totally. I think getting the whole form of a food is the best thing you can do, because that's where you're getting the fiber and the nutrition like you're talking about. And I want to add too with like the cancer thing. Eating enough, especially if you're going through cancer treatment, and a dietitian can help with making sure you're getting the right amount of calories and nutrients. Because, you know, going through cancer treatment, there's muscle wasting that sometimes happens there, depending on, you know, what kind of cancer you have. And so I think just eating enough, even if it's through liquids, I think is super important. We don't want wasting. Just making sure you're getting the calories in there.
Good. Well, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433. After the short break, we'll continue our discussion on everything diet-related with Erica Van Kalkar, Soleil Thiel, and Stacey Kloster from Dietitians of Alaska. Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by registered dietitians Erica Van Kalkar, Soleil Thiel, and Stacey Kloster from Dietitians of Alaska. Do you have questions about what a calorie is or how many calories a day are recommended? What about if tracking your diet is effective? If you have a question or a comment, call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so I got some more fun questions for you guys. I want to know about macros. And because I hear all the time, well, you know, you need a certain number of macros or the breakdown of the calories. So who wants to start here and describe what a macro is? No one is raising their hand, so I'm going to say Soleil. What is a macro?
Loaded question.
So macros are three things that all foods have. Carbs, carbohydrates, fat, and protein. There are suggestions for those. So just general suggestions is getting 45 to 65% of your calories from carbohydrates, 20 to 35% of your calories from fat, and 10 to 35% of calories from protein. Very general. That's basically the gist of what macronutrients are.
Okay, so every food, or I mean, not every food, but almost all foods are going to have three different components to them. Mm-hmm. And then when you collect these up throughout the day, saying in general, a general diet should have a percentage of each of these.
Correct.
Okay, so let's get into each of them a little bit, because it's so confusing to me anyway. Erica.
Yes.
Okay. What is a carbohydrate?
So a carbohydrate is kind of, think of it as, if we're using kind of like gasoline as kind of an example, it's almost like the nitrous oxide that, you know, you would put in a sports car to make it like go really fast. It's probably the most easy to access energy in a food. Then there, you know, from that, there are different, I guess, classifications of carbohydrate. There is a complex carbohydrate and there is a simple carbohydrate. Without getting into the chemistry of everything, because we don't want to do that. Basically, think of a complex carbohydrate is it's coming the way nature packaged it. So like a potato, pull a potato out of the ground, that is considered a complex carbohydrate. It has, you know, fiber, it has a little bit of water. It's going to take longer for the body to kind of get through it. Brown rice would be another example of a complex carbohydrate. An apple could be another example of a complex carbohydrate. Then you have simple carbohydrates. Basically, those just don't take as much to get digested and converted into energy by the body. So kind of the best example of a simple carbohydrate could be just regular table sugar. It doesn't take long at all for the body to break it down. That's why it's so good to use in, you know, with somebody who's diabetic, who's having a low blood sugar. It takes very little time for that carbohydrate, that energy to get into the bloodstream. And so, you know, we've got the whole food carbohydrate, we've got the more processed food carbohydrate. Neither one of those is good or bad, because food does not have morality. It just is what it is. But it's generally recommended that the diet contain more complex carbohydrates than it does simple or more processed carbohydrates.
Okay, so it's like white rice would be like a simple carbohydrate, or like candy bars.
Candy bar, yes. I think, you know, it's white rice, and I'm glad you brought that up, is yes, it is more processed. You know, to make white rice, you have to take off that fiber-rich hull. And they did that back, I want to say, like World War I, II. To make it more shelf stable. So it gets down the shelves here longer, could be transported, you know, overseas to the soldiers and wouldn't go rancid. But, you know, say, you know, so it's going to be digested quicker, but that's not to say that it shouldn't be consumed. I mean, most cultures nowadays do use white rice or form of white rice. So it's kind of a sticky area.
Well,
no pun intended.
I see what you did there, and I like it. Okay, so Stacy, you get the fats. Okay, but first you can comment on anything carb-related, and then you can add
in
the fats.
I did want to comment on carb-related, only because when it comes to simple and complex carbohydrates, and I think in general when kind of like the 2,000 calorie suggestion, it's more of like the general population. Just kind of going back to like having Crohn's, for somebody who has a GI disorder, oftentimes having those more complex carbohydrates isn't the best thing for my body. So being able to kind of recognize that, having a dietitian kind of walk you through that, that doesn't mean I always have to have the applesauce, but maybe I could peel the apple and not have maybe quite as much fiber. Kind of those little hidden gems to make it more individualized so that you still get kind of the whole foods, but maybe not the whole food. So fats is up to me. Oh, gosh.
Well, because I look at a label and I see saturated, unsaturated, mm-hmm. trans fats. So, I mean, I don't know the difference. Like, what's good, what's bad?
And kind of, you know, I think fats has been very popular in the diet world with the keto diet, if I might say that word on radio. And I'm sure we're going to get into that. But with fats, kind of knowing the difference between healthy fats, getting things from like nuts, avocados, salmon, versus having some of those fats that you're getting through more processed foods. I think it kind of goes back to that having whole foods versus the processed foods kind of still applies with that fat, thinking that like kind of just going on a very basic level of trying to eat fats from like whole food sources as opposed going to like the more processed, and then you should be kind of ahead of the game, I guess.
Okay. So before I go to protein with Soleil, we have a call from Trevor in Anchorage. Trevor, welcome to Line One.
Thanks. I'm loving the conversation. You know, my big question is about health related to, and nutrition related to milk. And milk from the cow, there's different types. And then you add all the nuts and the oats and all these others, and really just trying to understand what are the health benefits of one over the other and how to best select it.
Well, that's a great question, Trevor. I will pose that here to our dietitians. I'll have you take the answer off the air. Okay, so just to summarize for everyone, there's cow milk, and I know there's fat-free, low-fat, whole milk, just a bunch of additives, and then there's oat and soy and coconut and all the other types of milk. So who wants to tackle this question? Again, no hands. But everyone's looking at Stacy.
I was going to say, so.
I was going to say Stacy, because there's fat in milk. I mean, that's a big part of it. But there's also carbs and there's also protein. So they have all those macros.
And that is where, again, I'm going to kind of go individualized that, A, can you process lactose that is in milk? If you can't, then that kind of takes some cow milk off of the table. So that would probably, if you get GI upset, if you have like constant diarrhea, then you're intaking something that you're not going to be absorbing and getting the nutrients from anyways. So then having those alternative milks would be probably a better healthy alternative for you. If you are like me and I just don't like the taste of milk, so it's hard for me to get over that, then I turn to alternative milks. But what am I looking for in my diet? Am I looking for something that is going to give me some of those carbohydrates? Am I looking for something that's going to give me a little bit more protein because maybe that's harder for me to get? Then that would be kind of more the direction. It's very hard to recommend a product if the person, the patient, doesn't actually like it. It doesn't really matter whether it is the most superfood, everything that is in my fridge, on my counter, but if I won't physically eat it, it really doesn't do me any good. So I think also pairing that with what you like or can tolerate is a big component into it. I'm not sure if that answers your question or not.
I mean, I think it does. I mean, it depends a lot on what someone can tolerate mm-hmm. and what they like. And there's not necessarily a bad product or a good product. What I'm hearing today is everything is individualized. And if you truly have questions that you want an individual answer to, then you have to see a registered dietitian. Mm-hmm. Would that be a fair mm-hmm. statement?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you, Trevor.
We're not going to say no.
Trevor, that was a great question. And I have another email I want to get to, but I want to give Soleil her opportunity to discuss the protein.
Yeah.
And any comments on carbs
okay.
or fats?
Okay. The only thing I'll say about carbs are not the devil. I feel like everyone thinks carbs are the worst thing and you shouldn't be eating carbs. They're so important, especially if you exercise. And, you know, the fiber there with the complex carbs that Erica discussed. Carbs aren't the devil. Most diets out there these days, like keto, they cut out the carbs. I don't agree with that personally. Everyone's different, of course. But yeah, I just think carbs are important and everyone should be eating carbs. So that's what I'll say. Protein-wise, I think protein is just as important. You know, protein is the building blocks of muscle. It's the building blocks of enzymes that your body uses. Like, literally, your body uses every bit of protein that you eat. And you can get protein from numerous sources. It doesn't just have to be your meat, your fish, which are great sources. But you can also get protein through plant foods, too. Beans, tofu is a great source. What else? Lentils, veggie burgers and things like that out there these days. But, yeah, I guess that's kind of the gist of protein. Very important to, again, maintain that muscle mass. I think that's super important to maintain the muscle mass through your life, because at some point you do start to lose your muscle as you get older and older. So you want to have as much muscle as you can to prevent being frail or anything like that in your older years.
Okay, well, that's going to transition.
Everyone's looking at Erica for some reason.
You're not that old, Erica.
The oldest one in the room.
But before I get to, I know Stacy has a comment on that. I'm going to ask you this, Soleil, because yeah. I left protein to you specifically.
Yeah.
Can you get enough protein if you are a vegetarian?
100%, yes. Like I said, tofu, lentils. I do something called seitan, which sounds funny, but it's basically wheat gluten. So obviously, if you have celiac or you don't tolerate gluten, this wouldn't be something for you, but it's packed with protein, incredible amounts of protein. Of course, protein powders are out there too. I definitely have a protein shake most days, or just a scoop of protein in something. That's helpful. But there are some things you have to consider. The amino acids are very important for building your muscle. One of them is called leucine. It's one of your like vital essential amino acids. And typically plant proteins aren't as strong in that compared to your meat-based proteins, dairy-based proteins, but still you can definitely get your protein and it's not a problem at all.
Okay. All right. Stacey had a comment.
More so the comment that I just wanted to make, just because we had talked about a calorie, is that to note that both carbohydrates, protein, they both have 4 calories per gram, whereas fat has 9. So I just kind of wanted to throw that out there since we had kind of also mentioned calories. If you are thinking of the like 2000 calorie diet, or you know, 2200, whatever the case may be, kind of what your ratios would be and how many calories you're going to get from each one of those macronutrients.
So you don't have to eat a lot of fat to hit a lot of calories.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So I have a email here from Deborah, and so this will piggyback a little bit on your frailty comment, Soleil. But she wants to know if there's any, like, specifically diets for seniors as people get a little bit older. And let me read the rest of her email. But it seems like there are certain foods that are more problematic as you get older. And she's specifically saying, you know, they want her to eat higher fiber foods. But eating higher fiber foods, like, later in the day causes problems. So are there any diet suggestions for... I guess for seniors would be the general question. And Erica, since you're the senior of the room, as you pointed out, I will pose this to you.
Low blow. And so just so I'm understanding the question, Deborah is looking for like general kind of diet advice for as you get older, but well, yeah.
It so it seems as if it takes longer to digest my food as mm-hmm. I age. Particularly mm-hmm. problematic seems to be eating high fiber foods later in the day, while at the same time needing to eat more high fiber foods.
I gotcha. And so I think that's, you know, we can definitely give, you know, kind of talk general stuff now, but this, you know, this may be another good opportunity to just maybe even just like one appointment with a dietitian, just because then, you know, you and either he or she, because dietitians can be men, you know, can go over, you know, the particular foods that you're eating. And there may be then some suggestions, okay, you know, this and this are causing you issue. Let's just hypothetically say like broccoli, cabbage, which tend to be fairly high in fiber, kind of some of the call them gassy vegetables. And so can, yeah, cause some GI upset, bloating, gas, maybe even diarrhea. And a dietitian could then work with you and be like, okay, well, you know, these may also be good choices, but may cause less GI upset. Another example with fiber could be, you know, beans. Beans are really high in fiber, but, you know, if you think about your, like, your black bean, your red bean, your kidney bean, sometimes those can cause a lot of gas. Lentils tend to be fairly comparable in terms of fiber, but not as gassy. And like Stacy was saying with the apple, and, you know, Crohn's colitis, you know, even a peeled apple still has quite a bit of fiber, but you're taking away some of, say, the insoluble fiber, and leaving more of the soluble fiber. My dad calls it defarting the apple. Which is kind of a beautiful example. And those who know, you just know. So it may be for Deborah, you know, taking a look at, you know, just like writing down what, you know, what foods are kind of causing her an issue. And then meeting with somebody to just get different advice on, you know, on, okay, you know, these are some substitutions or things you can add to your diet.
Great. Well, we're going to take our second and last little break here. You're listening to Line One, your health connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us statewide at 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. After this short break, we will continue our discussion on everything diet-related with Erica Van Kalkar, Soleil Thiel, and Stacy Kloster from Dietitians of Alaska. Welcome back to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I am joined by registered dietitians Erica Van Kalkar, Soleil Thiel, and Stacy Kloster from Dietitians of Alaska. If you have a question or a comment, call us toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. We have a call from Kristen on line one. Kristen, welcome to line one.
Thank you. My question is that since we're going into the holiday season here and people will be having get-togethers and parties, what would be a good menu to set up for a nutritious and healthy but still fabulous Christmas dinner?
Love it. Thanks, Kristen. Thank you for the question. Stacy.
Well, I mean, if I had my choice, I would say some, you know, deer backstrap, some king crab, and a side of shrimp. And, but I do think, you know, when it comes to the holidays, and you're not just cooking for yourself, which I think sometimes can be a bit overwhelming. You're trying to kind of put on the presentation, feed the masses, appeal to the taste buds, all of those things. I think incorporating kind of your basic things where you have a protein, you have your carbohydrates, you have some healthy fats in there, and then you can't really go wrong.
Okay, I like it. So what about like a sweet potato souffle thing with lots of marshmallows on top?
Maybe marshmallows on half for those who don't want marshmallows, but...
Good. So there's good proteins. There's mm-hmm. going to be good proteins. You mentioned shrimp, I mean, game meats. There's always turkey and things like that involved, but also a good variety of carbohydrates, complex carbs, whole foods, less processed stuff.
Yes. And I think sometimes we get into that everything needs like a gravy or sauce to things to make it decadent, when just some like perfectly steamed broccoli can go a long way. So I think don't try to overthink it is kind of my advice, I guess. And just make sure that you have a protein, or maybe have a few different proteins. You have some healthy fats, you have some like complex carbohydrates, that if you want to try something different, go for like some quinoa or brown rice or something that you, if you're looking for a new recipe, try something outside of the box that you don't typically do.
Awesome. All right. Erica?
And just to kind of piggyback on that, you know, kind of reminding folks that, you know, Christmas dinner, or even, you know, if we think back like Thanksgiving dinner, it's just one meal. And so, you know, yes, I'm in 100% full support and maybe not marshmallowing, you know, the bejesus out of the already perfect sweet potatoes, or, you know, instead of, you know, two cans of cream of mushroom soup with the green bean casserole, you know, if you can do it with like one can and maybe a little whole milk, you know, so making those changes. But then two, it's like, okay, this is just a meal. How can, you know, you set up the rest of that day, that week, to support whatever goal you have? So maybe the house isn't full to the brim with, you know, cookies and pastries that you find yourself being tempted with, or, you know, having an agreement with your friends, your coworkers, of like, non-food presence, or, you know, having your guests take food home with them if you struggle with leftovers. So I think doing what you can with, you know, the Thanksgiving dinner, or like the Christmas dinner, but also recognizing that it's just one meal, and, you know, looking at the rest of the day and the rest of the week as well, and just trying to, you know, doing what you can to make things look more balanced within that entire week.
Great. I think that's a great advice. As well, we have another call from Gene in Wasilla. Gene, welcome to Line One.
Hi, how are you doing there?
Great, great. What can we answer for you?
Well, I have a couple question about you know, one of my favorite things is salad with purple cabbage and carrots, and then I put a lot of olive oil on it and balsamic vinegar. And I'm kind of wondering, seems to be very good for me for when I need to lose a little bit weight. And what is the effect of olive oil on a diet like that? Does that help promote weight loss, or what do you think is the working for me? Or why is it working?
Yeah, that's a great question, Gene. Thank you. I wonder if it's partly you're transitioning to just eating the salads too, might be helping with some of the weight loss, but oils are not all created equal. And so, Soleil, why don't we have you talk a little bit about olive oil or other oils, or if there's a weight or health benefit to the oils?
Olive oil is definitely a good choice. It is part of the Mediterranean diet. It is considered, I guess, anti-inflammatory, if you want to say that. When it comes to weight loss, you really got to pay attention to the oils, because like one tablespoon of olive oil is probably like over 100 calories, just that. And if you're not measuring, you could be doing 4 or 5 tablespoons of olive oil on your salad, and that could be an extra 500 plus calories you're adding to your day, which could definitely lead to weight gain for some people. So it's a good choice. I would just say be mindful of how much you're using and make sure you're maybe measuring it out a little bit better if you're not measuring it. But yeah, olive oil is a good choice. I think monounsaturated oils, mm-hmm. olive oil, avocado oil is a good choice, especially if you're like baking something or grilling something in a pan. But yeah, when it comes to weight loss, definitely just be mindful of those fats. As Stacy said earlier, 1 gram of fat equals 9 calories. So it can really add up for sure.
So it goes a long way. I mean, I heard at one point that when researching the Mediterranean diet, that sometimes eating olive oil with bread or carbohydrates sort of limits the absorption of the carbohydrates. Is there any potential truth to that, or is that kind of just an old wives' tale?
And this is Erica, and yeah, there's some validity to that, in that fats and proteins do slow down digestion. And so, you know, getting back to the caller, I think you're on the right track in terms of, you know, maybe just adding in, you know, the salad, the fiber, you know, the salad sounds very fiber rich, very filling, very bulking, which gives you that initial sense of fullness. But then the fat in the olive oil helps to slow down digestion a little bit, so you feel more satisfied or more full longer. Kind of same with the bread. The fat is going to prevent just the mixture of all that food. It's going to prevent it from leaving the stomach faster than it would if you just ate the bread alone. We go back to, you know, talking about eating for, you know, or with diabetes, and we want to slow that release of carbohydrate, of sugar into the bloodstream, we tend to pair most things with protein. Most proteins contain fat, so you've got then, to use a big word, that synergistic effect, to kind of slow things down.
That's super interesting. So what I'm taking from this is that not all oils are created equal. There are some oils that are better, like olive oil or avocado oil, things like that, rather than say like vegetable oil or mm-hmm. canola oil or something like that. But that you have to be careful because they are calorie dense. So, you know, substituting that from like a ranch or something could be good. But if you're using more olive oil, then you may be negating the effects. Would that be fair to say?
Yes.
Got it. Well, gosh, the time has flown. We only have about 3-4 minutes left. We did not get to a lot of the specific diets, so it gives us a reason to have you all back on the show. Okay, the one thing I do want to hit in the last 4 minutes, because we've mentioned it several times, is keto. I know no one really wants to talk about keto because it's a hot subject, but what's the keto diet? Is it effective? Who would it benefit? Anybody want to tackle this in 3 minutes?
This is Erica, and I'm not sure if I can do that in 3 minutes. but it is kind of my pet peeve. It is kind of my passion. And I think I'm going to answer your question kind of. And I think it's important I'm going to use the word fad diet, that we understand the origins. And I think the ketogenic diet is a beautiful example of that, in that, you know, long story short, the ketogenic diet was first, I guess, coined, I want to say, in the early 1900s, by a doctor at, I believe, the Mayo Clinic, for the treatment of pediatric epilepsy. So it's a medical diet, again, for the treatment of pediatric epilepsy. It was never intended to be for weight loss or weight management. It came about as they looked at the management of seizures in children and young adults when they were fasted, and they found that in the blood of these individuals, they found ketone bodies, and it developed from there. It's very restrictive. I had a patient actually not that long ago, or I guess a few years ago now, who her son was actually on the ketogenic diet for pediatric epilepsy, and his diet was 90% fat. So that's a lot of fat, so restrictive. In about 2003 is when they finally started to use a modified Atkins diet because it is lower in carbohydrate, so it is going to put an individual in that ketogenic state to get those ketone bodies released, which don't ask me what it does to the brain, but so that people could eat a less restrictive diet.
Okay.
How then that worked its way into kind of the mainstream. Stacey and I were actually looking for a timeline before we showed up here. Oh. And
well, I guess you got out of that question, Erica. We have to roll up here. If you want to see a registered dietitian, you can go to their website at dietitiansofalaska.com or call 907-644-8445. Special thanks to our guests for being with us today, registered dietitians Erica Van Kalkar, Soleil Thiel, and Stacey Kloster from Dietitians of Alaska. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Stay healthy, Alaska.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.